Hello, listeners. Good afternoon. This is Ted Marr on the Out of This World radio program, broadcasting from the studios of KKNW in Bellevue, Washington on 1150 AM. The program focuses on Out of This World information, including psychic phenomena, metaphysics, and predictions for the coming years in Seattle, the United States, and beyond. We will have only the best psychics and astrologers and others in the world on our program, and I guarantee it will be the most interesting radio program you've ever listened to, as you will hear information here that you will simply not hear elsewhere. I also want to say a big hello to our friends in Canada, the United Kingdom, Europe, and in Switzerland, who I know are listening. Guten Tag, meine Damen und Herren und meine Freunde. You can also follow us on Twitter at Ted Marr, OTW Radio, and on Facebook at Out of This World Radio. I'd like to just go ahead and start with our first guest today. It's we're speaking with Mitch Horowitz live in New York. Mitch, are you there?
I'm here. Glad to be here, Ted.
Wonderful, wonderful. For my listeners, Mitch is a nationally known writer, speaker, and publisher in alternative spirituality. He's the author of One Simple Idea, How Positive Thinking Reshaped Modern Life, and Occult America, winner of the 2010 Penn Oakland Joseph Miles Award for Literary Excellence. He's also the vice president and editor-in-chief at Tartar Penguin, a division of Penguin Books dedicated to metaphysical literature. Mitch writes frequently and discusses alternative spirituality in the national media, including CBS Sunday Morning, Dateline NBC, NPR's All Things Considered, The Wall Street Journal, The Washington Post, Time Incorporated, and CNN. He has written several wonderful books, and I've the purpose of my radio program here is to raise human consciousness, and I couldn't think of a better person to have on the show today than Mitch with his wonderful books. Mitch, could you introduce yourself to the audience, please?
Sure. I'm a historian of alternative spirituality. My first book was Occult America, which traced the history of supernatural religious movements in this country and how they've influenced the mainstream. And my new book is One Simple Idea, How Positive Thinking Reshaped Modern Life. And it surveys the history of positive thinking and also the effectiveness of positive thinking. I felt it was time for a book that took positive thinking seriously as a thought movement, as a philosophy that has affected this country, and also in a sustained and realistic way asked, does it work?
Mm-hmm. Wonderful, wonderful. Mitch, we discussed this a little bit earlier today, but could you tell us how positive thinking helped you through your childhood? I know you had some challenges.
Well, I did first become interested in positive thinking when I was a young kid, and actually, I start off the book with a full disclosure, which is that I have never thought positively by nature. I'm not somebody who naturally walks around with a rosy attitude. My wife is, my mother-in-law is. I've never been one of those people, and those of us who don't take to positive thinking naturally, those of us who aren't born, who aren't fortunate enough to be born with a natural optimism, are in many cases the ones who most deeply need it and who have to put their shoulders against it with some rigor. We suffered some of the financial calamities when I was a kid that I'm sure some of your listeners have known in their own lives. When I was young, we moved from New York City to a large house on Long Island that we could never really afford. And I was growing up in the 1970s, early 80s in my adolescence, and it was a scary time. Mm-hmm. We were worried we were going to lose our house, and financial concerns were kind of a constant drumbeat in the background of our lives. And I said to myself at the time, this was when I was age 12, 13, 14, this is either going to engulf me or I can see whether what I've been reading about the uses of the mind is really true. Every piece of literature that I could lay my hand on, from the Talmud to the essays of Ralph Waldo Emerson, came around to the idea that thoughts are causative, mm-hmm. that your attitude not only makes you a nicer person to be around, but that it actually influences the circumstances that happen to you. It actually makes an objective difference in the events of your outer life. And I was an experimenter, like many Americans. I saw no reason not to take a radical idea and try it within the confines of my own mind, see what happened. And I felt that positive thinking, generally speaking, made a really concrete difference in my life at that time. We did emerge from the crisis. We didn't emerge from it solely because of that. There were many factors involved. Mm-hmm. But as a child and continuing into adulthood, I always felt that the direction and nature of my thoughts had something to do with it, some influence. And I carried that as a question with me into adulthood.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating, fascinating. I have to tell you my own little story. Back in February 1978, I was hit head-on by a drunk driver at 110 miles an hour. And I woke up in a coma in the hospital after about a week being out of it. And I'll never forget that time when I woke up. And my first thought was how fortunate and how wonderful it was just to be alive. And that thought has carried me through some tough times, some challenges in life. Everybody has challenges since then. But I think you've done a wonderful job with this book. And anyone in the listening audience who's interested in the history of positive ideas or the and how it's shaped America in a good way, please, I urge you to read Mitch's book. You can get it on Amazon, or certainly if you go to the show website at www.outofthisworld1150.com, scroll down to Mitch's name to today's interview, you'll find more information. In your book, Mitch, I have to ask you these questions. You've mentioned a couple of different presidents who've also had been interested in positive thought and in spiritualism, too. Could you tell our listeners a little bit about Abraham Lincoln?
Sure. I write about Abraham Lincoln in my first book, Occult America, and one of the questions I was interested in that book were these rumors that Lincoln had held seances in the White House during the Civil War. Mm-hmm. And I researched it with a great deal of vigor, and as it turns out, the rumors are true. Lincoln did, in fact, hold at least two verifiable seances in the White House during the first part of the Civil War. We know this because he invited a reporter from the Boston Gazette to one of the seances. Now, Lincoln probably held these seances at the behest of his wife, Mary Todd Lincoln, who did have, throughout her adult life, a committed interest in spiritualism or seances, talking to the dead. Now, Lincoln's great legendary biographer, Carl Sandburg, made note of the fact that Lincoln apparently held a seance in the White House, and we know this because not only did the Boston Gazette report on it, but the Gazette's article was picked up by newspapers around the nation, including one newspaper in Georgia in the Confederacy. And Sandburg wondered why. Why would the president have allowed a mainstream newspaper reporter to be present for what could be seen as a compromising event? And this is one of the ways in which mainline historians, even men as brilliant as Carl Sandburg, don't have a full understanding of the occult and how it played out in America. For many people in the mid-19th century, seances and spiritualism were a matter of deep seriousness, but not for everybody. There were lots of Americans involved in these things, and for some of them, it was a novelty. It was a kind of a parlor game. It was an experiment. And I think that Lincoln holding this seance and allowing a Boston reporter to be present served a shrewd political purpose. Lincoln wanted to portray an image of himself as a commander-in-chief who is not overly encumbered by the demands of the war, who could kick back and sample a novelty in the same way that other Americans were doing at the time. So I think Lincoln was happy to have this story repeated around the country. Spiritualism was not a matter of scandal or embarrassment at the time. Lots of Americans were doing it. It was considered a novelty, an experiment. In some ways, the religious culture at that time was more open, more liberal than it is today in certain respects. Lincoln held another seance in the White House that had a more serious tone to it, where he supposedly asked for and received political advice from some of the spirits, but he had a good-natured and sometimes even a joking manner about all these things. I don't know whether he took any of this advice very seriously, but his wife Mary Todd certainly did. She was an absolutely committed spiritualist both before and after Abe Lincoln's death. So the question of whether there were seances in the Lincoln White House is that there absolutely were.
Fascinating. And Mitch, one thing I want to ask you about too, didn't Abraham Lincoln have a dream about him being assassinated in office?
Yes, and that's really a remarkable facet and back corner of American history. This was, again, something that the historian Carl Sandburg noted in his multi-volume series on Lincoln's life. Lincoln had a dream in which he looked in a mirror and he saw himself in double. He sort of saw his own doppelganger. And the dream was interpreted by his wife, Mary Todd Lincoln, who had deep mystical and spiritualist interests. The dream was interpreted by her to be a prophecy of Lincoln's own death. She felt that the president was foreseeing his own death and assassination in office during his second term, which of course came to pass. So this was an actual exchange that occurred between the president and his wife.
Fascinating. And Lincoln, President Lincoln wasn't alone, wasn't he, Mitch? I mean, there were other presidents, for example, Ronald Reagan.
Yes, you know, Reagan has been misunderstood in our country. It's very difficult. Biographers and journalists write about Reagan, and they can never figure out who was the man behind the curtain. You know, they could never understand or get at the inner nature of the man himself. It seemed to them like he was always on stage, and they wanted to know who the guy was inside the Reagan smile. And the fact is, it's almost impossible to understand Ronald Reagan and where he comes from without understanding his roots in certain forms of American mysticism, particularly positive thinking metaphysics. If you look at Reagan's speeches, his statements, things that he wrote going back to the earliest part of his political career in the 1950s up through the end of his second term in office, his attitudes, his phrases, they all bear the chapter and verse markings of ideas and phraseology from the positive thinking movement. What's more, and I go into this in some detail in the book, and I've written about this in the Washington Post, in Salon, and other places, it is absolutely a dead-to-rights fact that you'll find phrases and ideas in some of Reagan's speeches that are from the writings of the occult mystical scholar Manly P. Hall, a man who was born in Canada and lived most of his life, worked most of his life in Southern California during the time where Reagan was living there. So Reagan was imbibing all kinds of influences, and he was actually very comfortable and very at home with a lot of these New Age and mystical influences. Evangelical Christians have a deep affection for Ronald Reagan, and he had a deep affection for them, but he cannot really be described that way. In the broadest sense, Reagan was a New Ager. He spoke very freely about premonitory dreams, about his belief in UFOs, in psychical powers, in number symbolism, in good luck talismans. He believed that America had a kind of secret destiny in which it was supposed to impart freedom to the nations of the world, and this was more than just a political or cultural mission. It was a mystical, spiritual mission. He took that from the writings of Manly P. Hall. And there are lines in his speeches like, "Nothing is impossible," which he used to repeat from the 1950s up through the end of his political career, that are clipped and pasted right out of the positive thinking movement, which was something that his mother, Nell, was interested in. Ronald Reagan and his wife, Nancy, spent about 30 years of their lives in Southern California in a community of actors and artists, and they were proud of those ties. They were deeply shaped by those ties, and many of Reagan's friends were people who were part of the New Age and mystical culture in America, including a man named Carol Reiter, who is forgotten today, but who was actually a very well-known astrologer, the first and only astrologer to appear on the cover of Time magazine in 1969. The psychic Jean Dixon was a Reagan family friend. The Reagan's interest in astrology is well-known, but there were many, many other mystical strands and ideas that Reagan was interested in. And in some respects, Reagan was the embodiment of the New Age beliefs, these kind of free-flowing mystical beliefs in self-potential that are tied to no one particular religion, this very porous, experimenting spirituality. That was at the heart of who Reagan was. And we need a new understanding of Ronald Reagan in this country to really get at the heart of where he came from.
You know, it's interesting. I had Susan Miller on. She's a wonderful astrologer
from
New York last month.
Yeah.
And she's so accurate in her astrological predictions. One of the things that came out during the interview was that astrology was an integral part of European education, Mitch, up until the 16th or 17th century.
Very true.
Scientific method. And in India today, where I used to live, in India, they still teach astrology. You can go to a university there. There's several universities where you can get a higher degree in astrology, Vedic astrology.
Right. It's very interesting. Yeah, the way Vedic astrology is practiced there, it's a fundamental part of the culture. Mm-hmm. Now, here in New York City, we have a law, actually, that's still on the books. It's an old, what we call Blue Books law, that goes way back and is mostly in disuse against being a kind of storefront psychic or against fortune-telling. It's an anti-fortune-telling statute. Mm-hmm. And I'm planning on writing something about that one of these days because my contention is it's not constitutional. If you live in India, the practice of Vedic astrology is very much part of your basic religion. It's part of your religious upbringing, and we would see it as part of your religious rights in this nation today. So the idea that my home, New York City, has an anti-fortune-telling law, I think chafes against the fact that astrology is not only still part of the American scene, but it's part of the world scene and in some cases part of the religious upbringing, especially of kids and adults in India. So my next windmill to tackle is getting rid of that law.
Oh, that'll be very interesting.
See if I make it.
Well, if you need any help, give me a call.
Thank you.
See what I can do on that. Well, no, I went to India on a series of Fulbrights in the late 80s and about 10 years ago. I spent about 2.5 years in New Delhi.
Well.
And that's where I learned about karma reincarnation and especially about astrology.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just a fascinating subject. It really helped open up my mind, too, about other ways and other ways of knowing.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, one of the I have to give this. This is a quote, Mitch, you have in your book on page 203 of your wonderful book about positive thinking. It's a quote from Ronald Reagan. He writes, I went through a period of in college in the aftermath of World War I where I became a pacifist, and throughout the whole thing, the war, he thought it was a frame-up.
Yeah.
And it was interesting that idea in pacifism carried him through a very successful first and second term as U.S. president, concluding an agreement with Mikhail Gorbachev to dismantle nuclear weapons, which I thought was a wonderful achievement.
Yeah. Well, Reagan had an interesting quality about him, which I think also came out of his rootedness in the positive thinking culture.
Mm-hmm.
And it would confound critics, it would confound friends, but it was part of his resilience, it was part of his appeal. He could redefine himself very quickly based on the needs of the moment. So, for example, he ran for the presidency as a kind of flinty, iron-spined, cold warrior, but he actually ended his presidency as a global peacemaker. He probably got rid of more nuclear weapons than any other world leader in human history. So Reagan could very quickly redefine himself. He was a pacifist in the First World War. He was a liberal during the New Deal era. He started to move toward conservatism in the 1950s. He had a very strong and negative reaction to the student protest movement, of the 60s, and he styled himself as a conservative. He became a hero to conservatives. But he could always reverse course. You know, people don't remember this, but when Reagan first started signing peace agreements with Mikhail Gorbachev, his conservative base was in revolt. I remember one prominent conservative saying to me, well, I think the old man is going a little soft. Conservatives did not trust or like the fact that Reagan was making peace overtures and signing nuclear arms reduction agreements with the Soviet Union in its final days. They didn't trust the reality of glasnost or perestroika. Reagan also had a vision of what the world would look like in the post-Soviet era. It may have been a touch utopian, but he pictured free trade agreements in which nations would be engaged in cultural and economic exchanges across borders with as little barrier as possible. Now, whether that actually came to pass is debatable, but Reagan had a vision for the post-Cold War era, which most conservatives and most liberals didn't have at the time. So people sometimes find Reagan frustrating. They feel he was superficial. They feel he was a cipher. They feel he was shallow, because he would change positions. But there was an adaptability to him that was quite remarkable, quite resilient, something he had cultivated from when he was a young kid. And he very often spoke in terms of self-perception, being able to shift his attitude about himself in ways that reflected ideas from the positive thinking movement, which he was surrounded by when he was growing up.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I have to ask you, Mitch, is that you've got a tantalizing little sentence on page, it's right around 203, 204. Where you wrote that Reagan said that an interstellar war would unite both the United States and Soviet societies. I remember
right.
that quote, actually.
Yes.
I remember that quote, and I always thought, I wonder what was behind it. Do you know what was behind it, by the way?
Yes. Reagan, okay. He had UFO sightings that he okay. reported from the 1950s, from the 1970s. He was very open and unembarrassed in discussing his belief in UFOs. He would discuss the matter with friends. Lucille Ball, in one of her memoirs, recalls Reagan talking about flying saucer sightings. He discussed it with a reporter from the Wall Street Journal. During the whole course of his adulthood, Reagan was very open about these things. There was a refreshing quality about him, and maybe it was just a better quality about our country in previous generations in some respects. You could talk about things like UFOs or premonitory dreams or your belief in the afterlife without immediately being branded a nut. If Barack Obama was to talk about a belief in UFOs today, he would be pilloried, you know, 24/7 on cable television. Maybe because the media was different at that time, the speed speed and rapidity of the media was different. Reagan was able to get away with these things, to talk about these things. So he did believe in the reality of extraterrestrial life, and he made that statement that you just quoted to Mikhail Gorbachev. And at first, Gorbachev was unsure whether or not Reagan was kidding, whether he was pulling his leg, but he eventually decided that Reagan was serious. But for Reagan, that was a kind of an icebreaker. It was a way of saying to Gorbachev in one of their early meetings, well, you know, you and I are not at total loggerheads. If there was an interstellar threat, certainly we'd get together, which Gorbachev thought was weird, but he recognized that that was Reagan's style of breaking the ice.
Right around that time, maybe you'd heard this, Mitch, but right around that time that President Reagan made that statement in the late 80s, there was a Soviet a satellite that had been sent to Venus to do an exploratory mission. And from what I heard from the newscast, at any rate, this satellite was sent into the atmosphere of Venus, and as it descended, another object came shooting up from the surface and blew it up. And Reagan heard about that. Was one of the reasons why Reagan made that statement, as if there were other life out there. And for my listeners, this is out of this world. We do discuss UFOs.
Everything's
on the table. Absolutely. Absolutely. So I just wanted to let my listeners know that we're not restricted to a strict paradigm of what's knowledge. But I've always found that that particular statement he made very, very interesting. I was wondering what was the
power
behind
people
it.
Have never fully come to terms with Reagan. He was very difficult to classify. It's difficult for critics and supporters alike to see him as a New Age figure because he was conservative. But there is actually a long history of New Age conservative movements in this country. With the advent of the Woodstock generation, we've come to associate alternative spirituality with the counterculture. But when Reagan was growing up, and for most of the 30 years he spent in Hollywood, people would go to parties and they would hobnob at studio gatherings, and the conversation would be about tarot and numerology and astrology and palmistry. It was very much part of the Hollywood landscape, and that included conservative figures like Ronald and Nancy Reagan.
One thing I have to throw this out to you, Mitch. Do you think a politician nowadays, if he or she talked about the same things that Reagan did about higher spiritual values, perhaps, or alternative ways of knowledge, do you think they'd get the same kind of? Do you think that hit a resonance with the American public, in spite of?
Well, you know, today the news cycle is so constant, and news gatherers are looking for points of friction. If somebody made a statement like that today, I think they would be humiliated and they would be forced to retract it. Presidents and public figures had a little more leeway in the past, maybe because some of the spiritual experimentation that went on in the country was considered a little more acceptable in past times. I mean, we've talked about Lincoln holding seances in the White House. There were lots of Americans engaged in spiritualism in the mid-19th century. In the early 20th century, you could still find zodiac tables and farmers' almanacs. There were many farmers who believed that planting by the cycles of the moon had merit as an agricultural science. Franklin Roosevelt's second vice president, Henry Wallace, was deeply committed to mystical and occult and esoteric ideas. He would talk about these things very, very freely. Eventually, it became his undoing. But there was a certain degree of leeway where maybe religion was considered somewhat more off the table. Other things, people's private lives, people's sexual lives, were considered somewhat off the table. Today, everything is considered on the table, and media is such an unremitting presence in our lives that if somebody says something that can cause friction, it will be repeated over and over again to the point where it'll be unavoidable the next time that person is in public. So no, I don't think we could repeat the experience of Ronald Reagan where, I mean, he would sit down with interviewers both as a candidate and as president from time to time, talk about his beliefs in psychical predictions, talk about his beliefs in UFOs, in number symbolism, comment from time to time on astrology, and we kind of forget about it. You know, the life would just go on the next day. Some people would be alarmed, but it wouldn't change the weather. I don't think we live in that kind of country anymore.
Yeah, I agree with you there. But I think that a lot of people though are waking up to spirituality, to issues such as positive thinking. I think positive thinking is a wonderful thing, and it certainly helped me in my life. And I have to tell you, on the way here, Mitch, I was listening to a CD on all the recorded speeches from John F. Kennedy back in the early 60s and late 50s. And there were lots of interesting things he said back then, very inspiring. He quoted George Bernard Shaw in saying mm-hmm. that other people see things and ask why, and I dream of things and say, why not? Mm-hmm. And then this was in his plan to put a man on the moon, which was a very wonderful achievement for the time.
Yeah.
And then, of course, his famous line saying, ask not what you can do, what your country can do for you, but ask what you can do for your country.
Yes.
That kind of inspiration, I know it affected me as a young boy back then to go on and really make something of myself and try to make society a better place to live.
I think that's wonderful. I really think what you just said is wonderful. I've played for my kids. I have two boys mm-hmm. who are ages 7 and 9. I've played for them Kennedy's New Frontier speech. And mm-hmm. I think Kennedy and Reagan had a lot in common in that they both exemplified a kind of patriotic optimism. Mm-hmm. They gave people a sense of possibilities. Reagan would repeatedly say in his speeches, nothing is impossible, and Kennedy would make the references that you just noted, you know, mm-hmm. others ask why, some men ask why, I ask why not. And in effect, you can see in both of their careers and in those of other people that if America has one national unifying creed that you find across every line of race, politics, and background, it's the belief that thoughts are causative, that believing in possibilities almost helps open us to the possibilities themselves. Mm-hmm. If you were to go around the country and ask all different kinds of people from, you know, the tip of Maine to Eugene, Oregon, do they believe in the statement, attitude is everything? You'd find a great many people would not only agree with that, but could speak in a very impassioned way about why they believe it, about circumstances in their own lives that they feel they made it through because of their attitude. And you would find people from New Age spiritual centers to conservative evangelical ministries who would signal their agreement with that idea that attitude is everything, or that thoughts are causative, as I put it in the book. That's the challenge of the positive thinking movement. That's the challenge that it issued to America, that our thoughts actually have something to do in more than just a psychological manner with what happens to us. And you will find that idea at the heart of a lot of our religious outlook, at our business motivation, at our self-help, in our politics, and in our most intimate views of ourselves. If America has one unifying creed that people will agree with from all different parts of the nation, from all different political backgrounds, it is the positive thinking ideal that thoughts are causative, that commands the attention and the loyalty of vast numbers of Americans. Positive thinking is, in many regards, the American philosophy.
I couldn't agree with you more, Mitch. My foster mother, Terry, was a master psychic, and she, one of the most important things that she taught me was that thoughts are things.
Yes.
And it helps to visualize a positive outcome regardless of any situation in the fifth dimension, which takes precedence often will manifest here in the third.
And I'd like to interject that wonderful phrase, thoughts are things, was coined in 1876 by a Methodist minister in Massachusetts mm-hmm. named Warren Felt Evans. Mm-hmm. And Warren Felt Evans wrote a book called The Mental Cure and some of the earliest books of the positive thinking movement. And mm-hmm. that phrase has almost become one of the catchphrases of this country. You find it in business motivation. You find it in religion. It has traversed our culture. Mm-hmm. And it got its earliest start in the writings of Warren Felt Evans in 1876.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating. I've practiced it myself. I'll never forget the time I was traveling. I needed a typewriter to do some work. And I visualized walking into a thrift store and finding one for a dollar.
Yeah.
And I drove into this little town. There was a Salvation Army there. And I walked in. And just as I walked in the back, Mitch, the lady was bringing out a typewriter. She was just setting it on the floor. And I asked her, oh, that looks like a wonderful typewriter. She says, and I asked her, how much is it? She said a dollar. And I said, sold.
Now, what's interesting is, you know, I was just talking to a documentary producer about this today, that mm-hmm. there's a lot of cynicism in our society, and people will sometimes scoff at these things, roll their eyes at it, and they have their arguments and they have their reasons. But when you talk to people in private, mm-hmm. when you get away from the outward noise and when you get people out of whatever group or workplace they belong to and just sit across from them at a table, everyone has a story like that, or many such stories. People have stories about premonitory dreams and, you know, visualizing something and having it come true. Remarkable numbers of people from very different walks of life, everyone, it seems to me, has some kind of a story like that.
Wonderful, wonderful. I just want to announce that this is Out of This World with your host, Ted Marr, broadcasting from the studios of KKNW here in Bellevue, Seattle, Washington. For those who'd like to ask Mitch a question about positive thought, our call-in line number here, Mitch, would you mind taking some calls if we get some?
Be happy to.
Okay, our call-in line number here is area code 425-373-5527, or toll-free within Western Washington is 1-888-298-5569. One of the quotes I was reading through your positive book there, Mitch, and it said, talked about the law of attraction. And here's just a quote. Through the positive, proper control of one's thoughts, the law of attraction can be used to attain one's desires, money, goods, or whatever one desires. And that's been true in my own life. Have you had experience with that as well? I'm sure you have.
Well, you know, in that line, I was describing the law of attraction as it's seen, and I take that concept seriously, but I also caution people that I believe we live under many laws and forces. You know, you and I were talking earlier today about the question of physical illness, and one of the areas where I agree with the critics of positive thinking is that they will point out very vociferously that a person who is ill, a person who is in recovery, should not be told how to think. That can be a very cruel thing sometimes to visit upon a person. A person who is in need sometimes needs concrete assistance, very often in terms of time or money. And while I do think there is a remarkable relationship between the body and the mind, and there are things going on in placebo studies today that we couldn't have conceived of a century ago, there were remarkable findings and a real deepening question around the nature of the placebo effect. I do believe we also live under physical limitations. Physical mortality alone tells us as much. So I think we live under many, many laws and forces, both spiritual laws and natural laws. I don't see us as living under any one overarching mental super law. So I take the law of attraction seriously, but I think it needs to be approached with a note of caution. I think there are many, many things crisscrossing and going on throughout our lives.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. I have to tell you, back in, what was it? It was early 2000, Mitch, I was in Egypt. And I took a tour down the Nile from Cairo to Luxor and the different pyramids. And one of the things I learned there was a very important lesson about illness. About 5,000 BC, Egyptian doctors back then thought that there was a spiritual cause for many diseases. And they actually determined diseases as they split it into two infinitives, dis-ease.
Yes.
In other words, when one was stressed out, when one was under a lot of mental strain, that often exhibited itself in terms of physical illness.
Yes.
And so I think the challenge of the medical profession in this country and around the world in the coming decades will be to go into the spiritual causes for diseases, which will link up to the physical. Of course, when somebody has a physical problem, that should be addressed. But there's also often a spiritual cause as well.
Yes. And it's very interesting. You know, we have made so much progress in that area. Mm-hmm. In the 1950s, for the first time, Americans began to hear about stress as an actual health problem. And you might find physicians across this country today who say they have no interest in any of this positive thinking stuff. And yet, you know, in the next breath, they can talk to you very eloquently about stress related causes of disease, whether it's hypertension or chronic back pain or digestive disorders or irritable bowel syndrome. Over the past half century, we have realized more and more that some diseases, some functional diseases, do have stress as their primary cause. And there are physicians, including a doctor named John Sarno, who's a professor of clinical medicine at NYU Medical Center here in New York, who treat back pain more and more and other forms of chronic aches and pains and digestive disorders as the product of stress. And the results that they've gotten over the course of their careers and studies has been quite remarkable. So we have made incredible headway. When people talk about stress as a cause of disease today, it's widely and commonly accepted. That wasn't true in our parents' generation.
Mm-hmm. I agree. And even you could probably look at alcoholism as well, drug overdose, as a function of stress as well. People
that may very
escape.
Well be. In fact, I write the history of Alcoholics Anonymous in the new book, and the founders of AA, who I have just the deepest respect for, particularly Bill Wilson, they drank very deeply from the different positive thinking and metaphysical mind power literature. They were searching for solutions in every corner of the religious culture, and Bill felt that the nature and the patterns and the chronic habits of the mind played an enormously important role in the question of recovery.
Well, here's this brings me to another subject, Mitch, and I have to ask you about this as well. In your book, Occult America, you have a chapter about Edgar Cayce.
Yes.
And for those of readers who don't know about Edgar Cayce, well, I think, why don't you go ahead, if you don't mind, Mitch, and explain a little bit about Edgar Cayce. I know he's
a
medical prophet.
Edgar Cayce had a reputation as a medical clairvoyant. He worked, he was from the Deep South, grew up in Kentucky, and worked and lived in Kentucky and Virginia for much of his life. He died just before the end of the Second World War, and he had a reputation as somebody who could go into a kind of sleeping state. He was sometimes called the sleeping prophet, from which he could go into these clairvoyant trances and would diagnose and prescribe cures for a wide range of different diseases. He would analyze people's psychology. He would analyze their past lives. He would analyze where you came from in terms of past life energies or incarnations that you might have occupied. Cayce helped to bring mainstream interest to topics ranging from numerology to meditation to stress reduction to natural diets. He's known as the grandfather of the New Age. And he was also a Christian mystic. There was a deep, deep ethical core to Cayce, and that's something that I spend a lot of time writing about in my book, Occult America. Cayce can't be understood just as a medical clairvoyant or as a psychic or as somebody who spoke about and popularized different New Age topics like reincarnation or astrology, but Cayce was also a very deeply committed Christian, and there's a tremendous ethical backbone that runs throughout his work, and I love the man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was amazing. He was amazing. He was also warned, I think, Mitch, during his lifetime, that if he did too many readings, he would get burned out, and that's
yeah. He did die at a fairly young age. He didn't mm-hmm. live to see the age 70, and mm-hmm. he probably did suffer from a kind of burnout. He died fairly young, but the organization that he left behind, the Association for Research and Enlightenment, or ARE, is still very active in Virginia Beach. They are my favorite New Age center, and I'm actually giving a keynote address on Edgar Cayce and the positive thinking revolution at their members congress in the month of June. So if you go to edgarcayce.org, you can find news about that conference and my talk. And if you're not able to get there, they're also streaming it live over the internet.
Oh, fantastic. What a wonderful coincidence.
I'm looking forward to being there.
Yeah, wonderful, wonderful. Well, one thing I wanted to ask you, Mitch, I know, you know, for some people out there, times are tough, either in terms of career or relationships. And I was just wondering, from your own personal belief system, what kind of positive advice could you give my listeners out there to in terms of inner strength or how, you know, a positive attitude has helped you?
Well, that's a wonderful question. I would give the advice that I've received myself from friends of mine in the recovery movement. I remember there was a friend just saying to me several weeks ago, whatever you do, don't go dark. You're going to close up options to yourself. You should get up every day and try to make a gratitude list. Try to spell out what you're grateful for. Mm-hmm. I believe that when you're going through a difficult time, there are steps that you can take that will help pave the road. One of them, first of all, is expressing daily gratitude, engaging in prayer every day, reading scripture or another sacred, historic, religious text every day, engaging in forgiveness. It is just enormously important that we extend forgiveness to those around us, even people who have truly hurt us and may not visibly deserve forgiveness. I try to say to myself that the violence that sweeps around the world today has to stop with each of us as individuals, and the first step we can take in that direction, and sometimes it's a silent step, is just forgiving another person. I would also say try to be a little kinder to other individuals, even when you're going through a hard time. The great British intellectual and seeker Aldous Huxley spent his whole life experimenting with Eastern religions and psychedelic drugs and different spiritual and self-development systems. And towards the end of his life, he was asked by a reporter, what's the one method you found that made the greatest difference in terms of self-development? And he responded, it was just trying to be a little kinder to other individuals. And that's something that I can't say enough about. So mm-hmm. I would say, practice forgiveness, make a gratitude list every day, even if you think you've been there, you've done that, do it anyway. Pray every day, pray several times a day. Keep up with your religious reading, read scripture, read the Bhagavad Gita, read sections of the Talmud, read any kind of hallowed, great religious text that has withstood the passage of time, the passage of the ages. Extend forgiveness to people, try to be kinder to people, and engage in civility. We live in too dark a world in the digital age where texts, emails, postings are very often cynical and coarse. It sounds like a small thing, but it cumulatively becomes a very big thing. Engage in civility. I think those are things that in tough circumstances we can do for ourselves, and I would never prescribe them if I didn't feel they made a real difference. I would never prescribe them if I didn't do them or try to do them myself. And if you think something sounds ordinary, if you think, well, been there, done that, I don't need more prayer, I don't need more gratitude list making, do it anyway. Try it. Sometimes these things cumulatively hold more for us than we realize. So that's what I would try to impart.
Well, wonderful advice. You know, I agree with you totally, Mitch. I think the little things do count in life. I should tell you that before my foster mother passed away a couple of years ago, she was a master psychic, and she would give me life reviews usually every day regarding my thoughts and actions. And it was really cool. And one of the most important things that I learned during this time was that the little things do count. And if, for example, you go up to a stoplight, for example, and you see some poor guy there, he's got a cardboard saying homeless, lost my job, mm-hmm. no gas, you give him a couple of bucks. Or somebody's going into an office building, you hold the door open for them.
Absolutely.
Or a waitress gives you good service, you say thanks. Little things.
Absolutely.
You give her a good tip. Those little things, you believe it, it does make a difference in other people's lives. Because
I do believe that, and I would mm-hmm. go so far as to say that there's an extraordinary and easily overlooked metaphysical power in those small things. They mean so much, and I would encourage everyone not to neglect them. And I would also say that the secret to self-change, if there is one secret, mm-hmm. it's being hungry for it. There's an Arab mm-hmm. proverb, the way bread smells depends upon how hungry you are. Mm-hmm. The hunger for self-change, that absolute desire from the core of one's psyche to change, that tends to be the linchpin as to whether change occurs. And when it occurs, it can occur through these very simple devices like we were just discussing.
I have to tell you, Mitch, you're in New York City. I'm here in Seattle looking out over the beautiful skyline. And when I got here a little while ago, it's been quite an afternoon. There was a fire alarm. Everybody
yes.
had to evacuate the building. It was a gray sky. And while we've been talking, the sky and the studio is completely lit up in white light. And you've had a effect on this studio and on this area and on the 3.1 million people in the Puget Sound area extending into the 4 or 5 million people. The signal goes up to Vancouver and Victoria, and hello to my Canadian listeners as well. So I just want to, you've given us lots of light and really positive uplifting, and I just want to thank you for that.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it.
Yeah. And I know we've run over today. We were going to pre-record this early, but we were interrupted by a false fire alarm. And I know, Mitch, you have to get going. So I'd like to give you the floor now to say whatever you like for just kind of like parting thoughts to my listeners.
Sure. Well, you know, if there's one thing I've tried to accomplish in the two books I've written so far, Occult America and One Simple Idea, The History of Positive Thinking, it's that I want people to understand that if they have New Age and mystical beliefs, those things have very, very deep roots in that country. We speak of alternative spirituality, but those kinds of beliefs, spiritual experimentation, various mystical practices, the kinds of things that Edgar Cayce spoke about, they're in the groundwater of our nation. They've changed our nation. And spiritual experimentation, the individual search for meaning, is a fundamental part of what it means to be alive today. It's one of the best parts of what it means to be alive today. And I want to encourage people not only to feel at liberty to experiment with all kinds of different spiritual ideas, all kinds of different ethical ideas, but to do so with a deep and abiding respect for the spiritual search of others. We are all believers in one way or another, and we can help one another attain possibilities by looking into, inquiring into one another's belief systems and honoring the fact that we are part of a chain of civilizations, and we are very fortunate to live in a civilization where the individual search for meaning is encouraged and protected. And if there's one parting thought I would leave for the listeners, it is experiment. Try things. Make sure that you're doing it with an ethical backbone. Have a religious tradition at your back, whatever your background is, whether it's Hindi or Christian or Jewish or Buddhist. We need the traditions to keep us on the right path ethically. That's very serious. But within that framework, experiment, and you'll open up doors for yourself and other people.
Wonderful. I'd like to, I know Mitch has to get going here, but I wanted to end this interview with Mitch by quoting John F. Kennedy. John F. Kennedy, back in the early 60s, stated in a speech, "The U.S. sets a very high standard for the world, and we are like a goldfish bowl before the world." JFK wanted to make the United States like a city on a hill with the eyes of the world all upon us, doing things for right, not because they're easy, because they are right. And with that, he launched into the space program. And
yes,
some say, and I couldn't, and many Americans would certainly say that he had one of the most inspiring presidential terms in our nation's history. But Mitch, I want to thank you so much for coming on today, and I'd love to have you back at some point, any time in the future. And my friends, if you want to read, I urge you all to get a hold of Mitch's book, One Simple Idea. If you look at our website, www.outofthisworld1150.com, you can see Mitch's name. You can click on the audio for today's show, and certainly his book, both books, The Occult America and One Simple Idea, are fantastic books, and I'll urge you all to get a copy. And Mitch, hope you have a wonderful day, and thank you again for coming on.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure, Ted.
All righty. All right, Mitch, take care. Bye-bye. Now let's go to a commercial break with John Hogue.
Hello, listeners. This is Ted Marr, the host of the Out of This World radio program, and I'd like to tell you about Mr. John Hogue. He's considered one of the best scholars in Nostradamus and has an amazing track record of predicting all the winners of the U.S. presidential election with 100% accuracy for the past 44 years, as well as being able to accurately predict the weather patterns and political, social, and economic events, both in this country and around the world. Every year, Mr. Hogue publishes his predictions book, and we are very fortunate to have him now tell us about his latest publication, including his predictions for 2013 and 2014, including the Hopi Indian prophecies. John, could you please tell the audience a little bit about yourself and how you came to be interested in Nostradamus?
I have always been fascinated with the patterns of history, more fascinated like a doctor is about the patterns of disease, try to cure the problem. In the past, a continuing repetition of the same mistakes in different costumes and different political and religious persuasions in different cultures. But essentially, it seems the more we change, the more we stay the same. And there seems to be a critical mass of these collective habits reaching a singularity in the next few decades, where if humanity does not break out of this cycle of repetition, the civilization is threatened. So my books, which are 23 and counting right now since 1987, published in 19 languages, deal often with futurology and the more subjective science of prophecy, the traditions around the world, of which the most important of these prophetic figures is Nostradamus, which is what I'm best known for on History Channel and television, as well as in my book.
Fascinating. John, where can people obtain the copy?
Well, this book is called Predictions for 2013-2014 because it is essentially a look at a period of time between May of this year, 2013, till the end of 2014, which is literally a breath of fresh air of reform can happen to limit the impact of quickening history, which is going to begin in the next 10 years to be some of the most upheavalful and disruptive and revolutionary periods that human history has ever known. And so we are in a period right now, and this book describes it in all the dimensions, from politics to religion to economy to global warming, ecology, and human consciousness, that looks at forecasts dealing with how we can lessen the blow of these quickening times that are coming in the mid-decade, or even avert and speed up the possibility of what is also often promised in the future as a more balanced human race, a more enlightened human race living in the golden age.
Fascinating. Well, I think your book is on point, and especially right now at this time in history. And listeners, I strongly recommend everyone to obtain a copy of this publication. It's nearly 500 pages long, and it contains so much information that we really can't do justice to it in this short commercial. I purchased a copy myself, and I think it's one of the best prophecy publications that I've ever read. For only $12.50, you can have a copy of the full work. Or for only $3.99, you can obtain a shortened version.
For more information, please visit my website at outofthisworld1150.wix.com/outofthisworld.
Listen live at 1150kknw.com. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Hello, listeners. We're back on the air. This is Out of This World radio program with your host, Ted Marr, broadcasting from the studios of KKNW in Bellevue, Washington, 1150 AM. We've just finished an interview with Mitch Horowitz in New York City. He's written some wonderful books on the history of positive thought. And for the rest of this hour, for the next 5 minutes, I'll be bringing on Scott Lemriel. He's from Los Angeles, the Hollywood area. Scott, good afternoon. How are you today?
I'm fine, Ted. How are you up there in Washington?
We're fine. We're fine, Scott. Just fine. I had Scott on last week's show. He is the author of The Say Raise Agenda. It's one of the top-selling books on Amazon, and he has been in contact with both the Pleiadians and the Galactic Alliance for the last approximately 40 or 50 years. And I wanted to ask your have you on the show briefly for a few minutes to get the Galactic Alliance and Pleiadian perspective on world defense. What have they been saying anything about Fukushima and why the government's not cleaning it up?
Yeah, I would respond this way very clearly. You know, as you know, and probably people know, it was announced in the paper, there was testing done of the waters off Alaska all the way down to Baja and probably even down through South America, the whole Pacific coast of the North and South American continents. And there's no radiation detected in the waters now. As you know, Ted, they're expecting a huge plume of radiation found in the water out in the Pacific to hit here. With radiation 100 times stronger than all the nuclear bomb testing that was done above ground during the Cold War. And that never happened. And as far as the Galactic Alliance is concerned, let me just state, it wasn't our governments, hidden or otherwise, that had anything to do with neutralizing that radiation.
Fascinating, fascinating. Could you, for my first-time listeners, Scott, could you please explain who the Galactic Alliance is?
Galactic Alliance is made up of more than 450 million highly advanced, benevolent, space-faring races in just one quarter of our Milky Way galaxy. And they've recently decided to, because they have a new tool to do this, to intervene in the affairs of this planet, finally, to bring about an uplifting change instead of the pre-planned direction this is headed, which is towards destruction. That's significant.
Wow, that's amazing. That's amazing. Would you like to say anything else to our listeners? We've got about a minute left, a minute or 2 minutes left.
I would just say to them, there's a very special vibratory word known as hue that was brought here from other worlds. And if you just hue on the outgoing breath, ask to be shown purposefully hidden a truth on a grand cosmic scale, and this word will help you do that safely at this time.
Fantastic. It'll also provide some protection as well.
Complete.
Wonderful. Wonderful.
Yeah. It was asked on the Coast Show, actually, if this would protect them if someone approached them from another world and said, I want to have you for dinner, for instance. And I was asked, would this really protect me? And I said, yes, in fact, that's exactly what I'm saying it would do. But it's up to the individual to find this out on their own through their own experience.
My friends who are listening, Scott, could we, in the next minute we have left, could you please tell our listeners about your wonderful new book, by the way?
The Say Raise Agenda is about a race of beings, 18 to 25 feet tall, human, that sponsored and actually helped bring into existence human and humanoid and much other life form throughout the Milky Way and Andromeda galaxies and some others before they vanished long ago. They've recently announced they're returning to help do one thing, which is also answered in the Mayan calendar, and that is to retire evil as an experiment on Earth.
That's very profound.
Yes. Something was decided recently to actually change the prophesied destiny of this planet. And, you know, who are we to say what we call the supreme being or the source behind all life? But if it decides to do something differently with creation that works better and more efficiently, than evil is a cattle prod. Who are we to tell it can't do it?
My goodness, Scott. Well, that is very good news. We have about 15 seconds left. Any parting thoughts for our listeners?
I would ask them to pay attention to world events from looking at positive effects that, you know, like this testing of the waters not having radiation for Fukushima, and they should also be aware that those four reactors that blew their tops off were 100 times worse than Chernobyl, which killed millions, mm-hmm. and that millions have not died from this. Mm-hmm. Why?
Because we've had help from out of town.
And we're going to get a lot more of that.
Isn't that wonderful? Well, Scott, we'll talk to you again next week, my friend. I hope you have a wonderful week and a wonderful weekend.
Same to you, Ted. Thanks for having me on.
All right. My pleasure. Bye-bye.